I just want to introduce Maureen, who will give you tell you what's happening tonight. Thank you for coming out.
Thanks, everybody, and it's so really wonderful to see such a great crowd. I so appreciate everyone who attends every single time. I don't take it for granted, and those of you who know me know that I always worry about people coming to the show. So thank you so much for being here. It's a real thrill to see you. A couple of announcements. Fishtails has been running for quite a while, and I, in the past, used to be able to come to a show and tell a story and sign up right there. But we can't really do that anymore because I have so many requests for storytellers. If you are a storyteller in the audience or you know of a storyteller who might like to tell a story at an upcoming Fishtails, please see me after the show or send me an email before the show. And that way I can make sure to get you in. Okay. The other thing I wanted to mention, and I'll mention at the end as well, is our next show is September 12th. It will be on Schooner Adventure. So that's a Saturday night. If you want to mark your calendar now, please do so. I'm sure that that show will be incredibly well attended. And so let's get started. The theme tonight is Anything Goes. That means it's a storyteller's choice. There is no theme. And we're in for a rich cross-section of really interesting stories from an amazing group of people. But first, before we get started, I would like to honor our storyteller in residence, and her name is Virginia McKinnon. She's sitting right here at the front. She's going to be our first storyteller tonight. Virginia has been at every single Fishtails for the last 2 years, with the exception of, I think, one in the wintertime. She is a wonderful storyteller, always telling us about Gloucester and her family. And tonight she becomes the storyteller emerita for Fishtails as we transition our storyteller in residence to Mr. Jimmy Tarantino, which is who is. So we're thrilled to welcome Jimmy as our new storyteller in residence, and he will be telling a story later on. But let's get going. Virginia, please come up and tell us one of your fantastic stories.
Tonight, I like to relate some of the stories that my father told me about the Frontiero family in Gloucester. My grandfather was Polito Francisco Frontiero, and he was born in 1875 in Terracini, province of Palermo in Sicily. As a little boy, he had a little red cart that he would drag around with him, hoping maybe to pick up a fish at the dock or a neighbor may give him something from the garden. And so, consequently, he was nicknamed Polito Garrettieri, Paul with the little cart. My grandfather was a fisherman, and he married my grandmother, Vincenza Scimitaro, in Terracini, Sicily. Coming to America, he had a job in a factory. And my dad was born in Boston on Sun Court, which was next to Paul Revere's house. Remember my little sisters, they would kid my dad say, did you play with Paul Revere when you were little? So my dad's little sister, Anna Maria, she became ill with rheumatic fever, and her doctor advised the family to move to a warmer climate. So they went back to Italy, where they stayed for 5 years. And returning here, my dad was able to go to school only until the sixth grade, because he had to leave school to help support his family as a fisherman on his dad's boat. My grandfather had 8 children. Here was Joseph, my dad, Michael, my aunt, Maria, and Anna Maria. There's Rosalie, Salvatore, Rose, and William, we call Vito, and Virginia, which was my aunt, Vinci, we called her. My grandfather lived down the fort. He was at 14 Beach Court, was the first house on the right next to Pavilion Beach. The house was a duplex, had a large front porch and a first floor kitchen and my grandparents' bedroom. And upstairs there were 2 bedrooms, one for the girls and one for the boys, and the bathroom was in the basement. My grandfather, Nornu, he was a day fisherman. He would return each evening. But my grandmother, Norna, she would feed the children supper. But she did not eat until my Nanu returned home, and then they shared their meal eating from the same plate. My dad related to me that his little brother Sam would daily sit on the beach waiting for my Nanu's boat to be seen on the horizon. When he saw the boat, he'd be so overjoyed, and then he would run home so he could have supper with his parents. Sam was so angelic. He was blonde with curly hair. But Sam died at a young age, and Norna, she named her next son Sam, but he didn't survive. But the third Sam, finally, he lived to a good old age. And my Uncle Sam's son, Paul, he has the whale watch boat, the privateer down at Seven Seas Wharf. And my Uncle Joe's son was the late Paul Frontiero, the famous Gloucester artist. My first recollection of my Norna was Vicenza. She was always wearing these peasant-like clothing, the long cotton skirts and loose blouses, and always with an apron. Well, carrying on the Sicilian custom, naming the first child in honor of the grandparents, I was named in her honor, but my mother thought she'd changed the name from Vicenza to Virginia. So each of my father's siblings had a Paul and a Virginia. My dad related to me that sometimes times were very difficult fishing, and their home would be depleted of all food, and they would have no money. But then my Norna, she would come up with a hidden $20 bill. And oh, what joy. That was enough money to buy a barrel of flour, enough food to stock up the cellar to last until fishing was better. My beautiful grandmother, she died at age 53, or just before my third birthday. My grandfather remained at home on Beach Court, and he passed away at age 81. But my Aunt Vincy, she remained at home. She never married, and she stayed home to take care of her father. I remember visiting my Nanu often because the St. Peter's Fiesta was so special. It was just down the street, and all the family would get together there, and all the aunts and uncles and cousins, and especially we enjoyed watching the fireworks on Pavilion Beach. Nanu, he was such a delightful person. He was small in stature, but he was such a good man. I remember going with him on the electric trolley cars all around the Cape, and the fare was 5 cents. He chewed tobacco, and occasionally he smoked these little Italian cigars. He always had a big red bandana handkerchief. His children gave him one of the first television sets, and he loved to watch the Westerns. He would be proud of himself when he would warn the cowboys that a villain was near. He truly believed that the cowboys, that they could hear him. The TV was such good company for him. And sometimes he'd take the train in to Boston, to the North End, to buy his Italian coffee beans. And he had a little wooden coffee grinder where he would grind the coffee to make each cup of Italian coffee. I remember visiting my grandfather the day he became a United States citizen at age 65. He was so proud of himself, learning to write his name. He took the pen and paper, and very, very carefully, he drew each letter, Paolo Francisco Frontiero. Then he handed the pen to me and asked me to write my name, and I did with little effort. And he was so proud of me for being able to write my name with such ease. Thank you.
Virginia. I love her. I do. Our next storyteller is Dan Duffy. He owns a bed and breakfast in Rockport. He has told previous stories here at Fish Tales, and I don't know if it's going to be a continuation or not, but we hope so. Come on up, Dan.
And Maureen, maybe if I do not follow Virginia next time, she's a hard act to follow. Very hard act. I think some of you may know that I'm writing a memoir, mostly truth, part fiction. It's about the role of my brother and his impact on my own life. I'll always consider my brother a casualty of the post-Vietnam era, because when he came back from Vietnam, he went across country from New Jersey to Corrales, New Mexico, with a group of kindred spirits. And that was in the summer of 70. And then in December of 70, my mother got a postcard from a woman named Dee and said she and Rich went beside the Rio Grande River. They took LSD, and when she awakened, he was gone. And we've never heard from my brother since. So, my memoir describes Rich mysteriously reappearing, that's the fictional part, along with his 66 GTO, and he coerces me to retrace his steps going across country and reliving his memories and his experiences from that summer of 70. So with me taking control behind the wheel and him in the passenger seat, we relive those memories growing up together, and I was age 18 when the last time I saw him. So this is one of the memories that we recall. Do you recall our first trip in this car, Dan? Remember when I found Dad? Holy shit, Rich. Do you think that topic will chill me out? Because it chills me right to the friggin' bone. What's the matter? Are you afraid to talk about it? I don't know. I haven't thought about it in a long time. Maybe talking about it will do us both some good. You know, we've come full circle, you and me. Here we are again, side by side in my GTO. Well, I'm not sure I'm ready. When you found Dad, we hadn't seen him for over 10 years. Remember crossing the Pine Barrens on that lonely stretch of single-lane Route 70? Bouncing and hearing every seam of those 50 miles to nowhere? Yeah, I do. And remember, we couldn't find any FM stations, so Joplin was our salvation? You're right, man. Put on Joplin. Don't you just love Peace of My Heart? I love her bluesy voice, I said as I exchanged the canned heat tape for Janis Joplin's. The music transported me back in time. It was the spring of 68, and Rich and I were driving to see my father. I was a high school junior, and I fantasized about getting my license and buying a car. So guess where we're planning to meet him, Rich asked. I don't know. Well, we're going to the same place I found him, in a good old-fashioned Haddonfield bar. Really? You found him in a bar? Yeah, I wanted to find him before I left for NAM. Well, how come? Because I wasn't sure if I'd be coming back in a body bag or not. Damn, Rich, I would have been scared shitless. You know I was afraid for you, right? Yeah, I know everyone was. So how'd you find Dad? Well, last week I drove across Jersey. I walked into one Haddonfield bar after another, and wouldn't you know it, I found him sitting in O'Malley's. His back was to me. I walked up behind him and tapped him on the shoulder. I was dressed in my U.S. Marine Corps dress blues. He turned his head and said, can I help you? I said, do you know who I am? No, should I? He said, shrugging his shoulders. I looked at him directly in the eyes, stood as proud as I could, and said, I'm your son, Rich. Wasn't that a hell of a shock for him? I wasn't sure if his surprised look was because he recognized me or maybe he shit in his pants. Maybe it was a little of both, I said. So here we are again, going back to O'Malley's. Sounds like a great place for a family reunion. Yeah, our old man didn't have a clue about what a real family was all about. To him, home was right between two other guys beside the bar. Geez, Rich, what kind of father abandons his five kids? He just vanished from our lives. My stomach began tightening just thinking about seeing him again. What would I say after all this time? What would he say to me? I wasn't sure seeing him again was such a good idea, but I was glad Rich was there with me. He'd know what to do. I followed Rich through the back door of the tavern, overcome with the smell of pungent smoke and stale beer. I recognized Dad sitting on the bar stool, his beer in one hand and a cigarette in the other. A fringe of curly brown hair ringed his shiny bald head as if it were demarcating the equator. I didn't know then that this would be the first of three times I'd see him over a 40-year period. Dad put his glass and cigarette in the bar beside an empty shot glass and said, hey boys, what are you drinking? I'll have a draft. No more shots for me tonight, Rich said, pulling out a pack of Marlboros as he sat in the stool beside Dad. I'm only 17, I said, standing next to Rich, a forced smile on my face. Oh, right, I guess you'll have a Coke. Sure. It's good to see you again, son, Dad said to Rich. Yeah, it's good to see you too. Two times in 2 weeks is a world record. So you going to drink with your old man, Dad said to me. I hesitated. Not really. I just came for the ride over in Rich's GTO. So you're going to NAM, Rich, Dad said. Keep your head down and don't be a hero. There are too many dead heroes, if you ask me. I will. I put my hand on Rich's shoulder, looked him in the eye, and said, I'll pray for you every night, Rich. Thanks, I'll need it, little brother. Rich and Dad remained at the bar, chain smoking and drinking. I headed to a darkened corner, picked up a few darts, and played a solitary game, waiting for Rich to give me the high sign. It was after 10 when he nodded in my direction and said, we better get going. We got a long ride home. I shook Dad's hand, avoided eye contact, and said, see ya. Then I walked back down that darkened hallway, hoping it would be the years before I ever saw his sorry ass again. My stomach was queasy. Why didn't he ask me how I was doing in school or work? It was all about him. I'm glad Rich had to sit next to him at the bar and not me.
Thanks, Dan, so much for the update. We're going to take a small break because we are adding some more chairs, as I know that there are some folks in the back that might like to come up and sit down. And if not, we can perhaps move them in the back there, too. So if you need a chair, come and get one.
There's a eight more down here.
Okay, just a quick break, everybody. Back to the storytelling. Hey, everybody, we're going to start up again. Our next storyteller has her back to me right now, which is Cindy.
Yeah.
It's a joke. Our next storyteller is Cindy Szymanski, and she's also been a regular here at Fishtales. She's a wonderful storyteller. She always has beautiful language in her stories, and so please welcome Cindy Szymanski.
Little switcheroo in who's speaking. It's okay. I based this on a theme from a previous Fishtales, Maureen's favorite, rock and roll. Thanks again for the inspiration, Maureen. I also dedicate this to my brother Fritz, who is here with us tonight. Bro, we had it rough, but thank God we had each other to get through it. So now this is a record of my teenage life. See if you notice any of your favorite bands, song titles, and lyrics. When I was a teenager, the title of some rock and roll songs became our CB handles. Mine was Dreamweaver, Where That Train Crossed the Highways of Fantasies, to help me forget today's pain. But not wanting to explain that love was a battlefield at home, I changed it to Foxy Lady. The boys all wanted to take me home then. It wasn't just Hendrix asking me, are you experienced? Tull's Aqualung kept me afloat, even though my old man had taken his last breath. Stepdad appeared like a bat out of hell, and we weren't in Kansas anymore, as our spirits were belittled to dust in the wind. The genesis of this sadness came as a message in a booze bottle. There was no salvation, even the Sabbath was black. He was tough as Iron Man, and the time was here for him to spread fear. Like the man on the corner, he was a foreigner to a peaceful existence. I wished upon a star that I wouldn't be sacrificed at the stake. I wanted to shout at the devil, but instead joined the motley neighborhood crew to escape his theater of pain. We were rockers trying to believe in magic that could set us free. It was no rock and roll fantasy. When disco tried to invade the airspace, it was only good for the dance floor, where bad girls went on ladies' night. But the beat couldn't rock the boat for too long, so we had a celebration at its last dance. Hey, Vinnie Barbarino was a rocker before Saturday night came and dressed him funny. He had flair in that polyester, but rock and roll was staying alive. The Bee Gees gave us the heebie-jeebies when we got stoned. So we turned into the Grateful Dead and rolled another joint with Tom Petty, getting comfortably numb instead. We thought we were born to be wild as we took the magic carpet ride. We sailed away with sticks and stones and let the cat out of the dime bag so all would be even Stevens. These were the times I was leaping and a-hopping on a moon shadow. Unlike George Thorogood, we did not drink alone. Since hell is for children, we needed an escape, and dirty deeds were done dirt cheap when you had more people chipping in for the beer because cha-ching, money, it's a crime. We didn't have much, so we kept our tricks cheap. Zeppelin got the lead out and revved us up to party, sometimes with bad company. And we wanted to climb the stairway to heaven when Robert Plant asked us to squeeze his lemon, but we're dazed and confused because you know sometimes words have two meanings. My adolescence was in the battle of evermore, problems at home, and my spirit was crying for leaving. The boy came trucking in saying, I want to make it with you. At first I thought, it don't matter to me. Then after another, baby, I'ma want you, it was like butter on my bread. Reality is stranger than fiction. Oh, Daddy, you said to wait for marriage. The boy said, won't you open up the door? It feels like the first time, like it never will again. My wheels were turning, trying to live every moment, thinking, I gotta feel more. When I first saw him, I thought, here comes trouble that's bad to the bone. We rocked steady and gave it time. Some songs we listened to set us free to fly like an eagle. Now we party until I can't fight this feeling. We feel like making love, and we can't get enough. And when the rumors fly, I don't want to know the answers. Don't stop the chain of dreams with the question, who do we love? I could hop on the peace train at Grand Funk Railroad, where I could feel him in the morning, because I knew I'd be taken out to the battlefields, where I'd hear my parents scream and cry. I wanted to make a new world, because I couldn't make the old one right. I'm crying, we gotta get out of this place. Don't let me be misunderstood. I'm mad, just like the rest of the caged animals. I couldn't stop looking back. Reality kept creeping up to my consciousness. I'd take it to the limit, living life in the fast lane, hoping for that peaceful, easy feeling one of these nights. But the grand finale was a grand illusion. I've been down so long that I was fooling myself, thinking lighting my fire with night moves would help me turn the page. But my efforts were going against the wind. I had thought Mr. Some Kind of Wonderful would give me shelter, but he was only an urgent, hot-blooded, dirty white boy playing head games. This hard-headed woman was seeing double vision. I wanted him to treat me right, but he hit me with his best shot. And later, after playing games without frontiers, I could only think, look what you've done. In his lion eyes, I saw that it was wasted time and knew I had to take it easy. I learned you can't always get what you want. And I could dream on, waiting for the sweet emotion. So I had to get back in the saddle or walk this way, wounded for the rest of my life. For crying out loud, life is a lemon and I wanted my money back. I was revved up with no place to go. I really just wanted somebody to love. So I was back into hell where the past mistakes are the objects in the rearview mirror that appear closer than they are. I was chained and going in circles. Mama told me not to come here. I've already got enough heartache from liars who put no joy in my world. It ain't easy to read the writing on the wall. I was the queen until the kiss-off that was like a bee sting. I had the moody blues. Life was a question of balance. I thought, I ain't got nobody to save me. I was the loneliest rider in my life. I was so old, very young, when I had to entertain the thought of only dancing on this earth for a short while. As a rider on the storm, I wanted to walk through the doors and break on through to the other side, where morning has broken like the first morning. Not be on the dark side of the moon, always on the run, then hitting a wall until the great gig in the sky. I was down on me when the ball and chain took a piece of my heart. All is loneliness, but I won't cry, baby. I'll just try a little bit harder. I'll journey after the fall and faithfully concentrate on the troubled child inside of me. No more negative chain reactions. I was spinning my wheels about when I die, then thought of the smiling phases of my life. I was always with my brother, who was like a bridge over troubled water, helping me to dream on where half my life is books written pages. He was one of the people who have made me so very happy. God bless this child then. You got that right. I was free as a bird one more time. I was in overdrive taking care of business, acquiring a positive attitude. Hey, you ain't seen nothing yet. Yes, we are fragile. I've seen all good people, owners of a lonely heart, do a roundabout and create wondrous stories. Now I was one. I feel free where I can have my own space, like being on a jetliner with the music rocking me. I thought about what I would leave this time when it actually was the end. And through my blood, sweat, and tears, I've always known that when I die and when I'm gone, my writing will be my child in this world to carry on, carry on. But for now, heaven can wait.
Could I just see a show of hands who would like the soundtrack to that particular? I want that soundtrack. Thank you, Cindy. Our next storyteller is a really remarkable woman, Bobby Gibb. You never know who you're going to meet. Bobby is an artist. She's a sculptor. But a really remarkable thing about Bobby is that she was the first woman to ever compete in the Boston Marathon, for real. She was the very first one ever. So welcome, Bobby Gibb. Give her a big round of applause, please.
Got my own clock here because really nice of Maureen to invite me to speak, and nice to see all of you here. I'm not used to speaking in public, and I'm not used to keeping time, 5 minutes, so I've got this going. Oh, okay. So I first saw the Boston Marathon in 1964, and I fell in love with it. And at that time, the Boston Marathon was the only major city marathon, and hardly anyone ran, not even men run. And for a woman to run was really outside the social norms. And for some reason, I fell in love with it. I just love to run. I've always loved to run ever since I was a little kid. And I'd see a green field, and I'd just go tearing across the field and leap into the air. And for me, running expressed it a love of life. And I continued to run. Everyone else settled down, and I was still running in the woods with the dogs, and my parents thought I was totally nuts, and probably everyone else did too. But I saw the marathon, and for some reason, I fell in love with it. Totally irrational. I didn't even know that women weren't allowed to run at that point in the marathon. So I just started training. I had no books, no coach. I wore nurse's shoes because they didn't make women's running gear in those days. And that was the only sturdy shoe I could find. And my training was fairly unusual. I took a 3,000-mile trip across the country in my father's Volkswagen bus. He had made out into a camper. It was the love of his life. But he and my mother had gone on sabbatical, so it left me the car. That was his big mistake. And so I had a Malamute puppy named Moot. And so Moot and I set off across the country. And I just loved this country. I loved the earth. I was in love with the whole country and the people. And so at night I slept out under the stars. And during the day I would run in a different place all the way across the country and meet people in the truck stops and so forth. And I got out to Nevada, and I remember lying down at night and looking up at the stars, and there were more stars than I'd ever seen. It just totally blew my mind. It's like, what is all this doing here? It was just so beautiful. I mean, I've always just been kind of in love with the universe and amazed at anything exists at all, and all these molecules and atoms and photons, and I go, why? It's a huge miracle, and nobody even sees it. But I was just enthralled with this whole thing. I went all the way to California, and by the time I got to the Rockies, I was running, I could run 30 miles at a stretch. And I came back, and in then I moved to California. Then in February of 1966, I wrote for my application. And at that point, I was running 40 miles at a stretch, and I had run 65 miles of the Woodstock equestrian cross-country race. And I got a letter back from the race director that said, women are not physiologically able to run marathon. And furthermore, they're not allowed to because it's a men's division race, and there are no marathons for women. The longest women are allowed to run is a mile and a half. And I was furious. I mean, I was so upset because here it was again, was this mindless prejudice. If you're a woman in those days, you had to live in this little box, and the professions were closed to you. You had no opportunities, no options. You had to get married. It was sort of like Pride and Prejudice. You had to get married. That was your meal ticket, and then you had kids and took care. And I wanted to get married, and I wanted to have kids and everything, but I also wanted to do a lot of other things. And so here it was again, if you belong to a certain class of persons, you can't do something, you can't be who you are, you can't manifest your talents and your abilities and so forth. So I said, all the more reason to run. So I took a bus back across the country, Greyhound bus this time, arrived the day before the race. My parents thought I had gone around the bend. My father actually thought I was delusional. But I convinced my mother to drive me to Hopkinton, where the race started. And then I hid in the bushes right near the start of the marathon. And when the gun went off, I waited till about half the pack went by, and I jumped in. And I ran, and in a few minutes, oh, by the way, I was disguised. I had my brother's Bermuda shorts, a new pair of boys' running shoes, and a blue hooded sweatshirt with the hood pulled up. And so, but within a few minutes, the guys behind me studying my anatomy realized that I was a woman and said, is that a girl? You know, so I smiled, turned around. And to my great relief, the men were friendly and supportive because they could have easily shouldered me out of the race. But I took off, and I said it was getting hot at this point. I took off the sweatshirt and ran all the way to Boston. And of course, the newspaper reporters realized there was a woman in the race, and they were following me along and broadcasting my progress. I went by Wellesley College, and the women just went crazy. And there's one woman standing over on the side with a whole bunch of kids, and she goes, Ave Maria! Ave Maria! You know, and I'm sorry. This tear is running down her face, you know. And you know, the tears in my eyes when I saw her there. So I ran all the way to Boston, horrible blisters, totally dehydrated. I didn't know you're supposed to drink water while you ran a marathon. So I had drunk no water. I thought it would give you cramps if you know. So I got to Boston, and I finished ahead of two-thirds of the men. And the governor of Massachusetts, John Volpe, came down and shook my hand. And the next day, it was front page headlines, Hub Bride, First Gal to Run Marathon.
Amazing? Right here in Rockport. She's an amazing sculptor. You have to go see her work. It's beautiful. Our next storyteller is a very talented young storyteller, young man, and a great new writer. His name is Adam Kuhlman. Please come up here, Adam.
I can't believe I'm about to tell this story in a church. It's titled Skinned. Not that it sits at the tippy top of my bucket list, but should I ever be stricken with tuberculosis, I will ask you to refer to my illness by its old-fashioned Victorian name, consumption. Or if you're feeling especially hammy, you could go with the White Death. Back when people weren't burdened by niceties like indoor plumbing or research-based science, they always came up with better, more romantic names for things. Today, a doctor will merely diagnose you with typhus, but in 1850s London, you would enjoy the distinction of a case of jail fever. Similarly, there's not much glamour in coming down with syphilis anymore, but back in the day, your genitals would have harbored the French pox. Something altogether more sophisticated, chic even. When it came to naming maladies of the skin, the Victorians exhibited a particular flair. Scrofula, carbuncles, a bacterial infection of the face and extremities they dubbed the eel thing. I take a special interest in such dermatological conditions because for years, my skin has shown little willingness to protect me and a corresponding hospitality to the most unsavory of pathogens. The typical Gloucesterite can step outside and blithely subject himself to a host of environmental hazards, blistering sun, chapping wind, or perhaps a barefoot walk on Pavilion Beach. But I must cower and coddle with ointments and avoid offending my skin in any way. I realize this may sound a little kooky, but the mistrust arises from 2 decades of betrayals, circumstances when my skin was my worst enemy. The first and most painful treachery came to pass during the summer of my 19th year, when I was working as a camp counselor in the deep woods of Western Virginia. One morning in the shower, I noticed a small red bump on the lowest point of my scrotum. Initially, this wasn't particularly concerning. The deciduous southeast is home to all manner of spiders, flies, and biting insects, of which New England is blissfully unaware. For instance, the noble chigger, a species of mite that likes nothing so much as the moist, clement depths of a college boy's underpants. I assumed I had a few days of awkward scratching to look forward to, but nothing serious. This outlook changed the following morning when I awoke with a hot, leaden sensation between my legs. Visual inspection revealed a testicular pouch the size, firmness, and hue of a ripe mango. I was driven post haste to the nearest emergency room and treated to a series of medical examinations, which included vigorous palpation of the affected region, as well as an exceptionally unpleasant ultrasound. The technician was an older woman with ropey forearms. With ropey forearms and a smoker's cough. And as she varnished my balls with conductive jelly, the following exchange took place. Her. They say scrotums get this big on chimpanzees. Me. Yeah? Her. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I was diagnosed with high-grade cellulitis, an aggressive skin infection that I must caution you against Googling. on doctor's orders, I spent the next week splayed on my parents' sofa, draping across my loins nothing heavier or more restrictive than a linen napkin. As luck would have it, my parents were renovating their home at the time, which led carpenters, painters... and assorted men in boots to stumble through my sick room. At first, these fellows could not help but be startled by my state of undress and my poorly concealed, still gigantic scrotum. But eventually, they took on a chummy, wink-wink sort of air. No doubt having concluded that my affliction stemmed from the staggering quantities of unprotected sex accorded to the well-endowed. Somehow it eluded them that, based on the skewed evidence, I was all beans and no Frank. Amazingly, this was the least complicated phase of what turned into a four-month cascade of horrors. I will not recount them all here, unless each of you is prepared to sign a waiver. But I will say that I became something of a celebrity within the medical establishment of my college town. After an initial appraisal of my nether parts, doctors would breathlessly invite others in to gawk and cringe. Nurses, medical students, janitors, whoever happened to be hanging around the office. I will also say that in my darker moments, I wondered whether the most sensible plan of action might be surgical castration. But finally, mercifully, one specialist cured me with just the right cocktail of antibiotics, fungicides, and Vietnam-era defoliants. This treatment was capped by an intensive course of topical steroids that left my scrotum as soft and smooth as a freshly shorn lamb. It turns out that, aside from infections, all sorts of cysts and nodules can grow on the human epidermis, and I have been beset by most of them. If I were to wake up tomorrow morning with something truly bizarre germinating from my shoulder, a tiny cartilaginous bust of Jimmy Durante, let's say, I would not be the least bit surprised. But I would hope that the scientists would let me, the first ever victim, come up with a proper name for the deformity. After all my years of anxiety and discomfort, I think I could teach even the Victorians a thing or two.
Adam Kuhlman, so talented. Our next storyteller is Ken Rayoff, and I do know that he has just recently spent some time on the ocean. And I recently just came back from a sail trip with Greg, and being out there in the middle of the ocean is just one of the most amazing experiences. It's really, truly remarkable, and being here in this beautiful area, I recommend everyone try to get out there at least one time in your life to experience it. But Ken, where are you? Please come up here and tell us your story. Ken, read.
Hi, thanks, folks. I'll never be able to eat mangoes again, I don't think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just got back from George's bank. That, by the way, that's not where George Sibley keeps his money. It's not big enough. But I was out on an eight-day trip out to the Hague Line aboard a 110-foot steel scallop out in New Bedford, the Kathy Marie. And we had a crew of 10 people out there, and we covered about 1,000 miles out on the out to the northeast peak there. It's the 200-mile limit, and of course, you know, it falls off the bank there into the canyons and then off to the continental shelf. And we were around, you know, going around there taking pictures of the bottom of the ocean for the sea scallop industry. We took over 3 million pictures of the bottom to see what, like doing a stock assessment of what's going on there. But of course, you know, in anticipation of going out, you know, you always wonder, am I going to keep my lunch down? Now, I used to go fishing back in the 70s and 80s, and I spent, many years fishing, but it had been 30 years since I'd been out, so I was wondering, oh, am I going to, and there's a lot of euphemisms for throwing up. I mean, does anybody, I don't know, what are some, what is it? Yeah. Well, does it, I mean, yeah, I'm going to say them anyway, but I mean. But, you know, there's, I got to talk to Ralph about a Buick, screaming at your shoes. What are the other ones? Airing the carrots. What is it? Feeding the whales. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of them. Chumming, yeah. But, you know, I would be okay. But on the second day, it was a little sloppy. It was pretty nice for the most part. But on the second day, I got real close, and it just made me think of my first day fishing back on the Peggy Bell, your grandpappy's scalloper. And so there it was. You know, I had been working on the state fish pier for many years and driving a forklift, and I thought I would get a sight on a boat. So I asked people, what do you do? How do you get it? And they would tell me. And one of the things they said was that if you get seasick, what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to, go to the rail, do whatever you're going to do, and then get back to work because you don't want to be a layback. You've got to throw it and then back to work. And so there it was through my good friend, the wonderful Ann Finney Natty. She introduced me to Peggy Sibley, and she said that her husband was looking for someone to be on board, and that he was down the Moore Sibley Wharf, and he would be painting the boat. So I went down there, and I saw this guy. He's covered with bottom paint, and he had lost an eye during the war. He had a frosted lens here, and the other one was covered with bottom paint. He had these giant milk cans, for arms. He was 6'2", and he came out from behind the boat, and he said, what do you want? And I said, well, I'd like a sight. And, first I asked him, I said, are you Bill? And he said, indeed, that he was. And he said that he was looking for somebody. And so a couple weeks later, I got on board, and basically, it was that first day, and you're nervous. You want to do a good job. And I did. We went out to Jeffries, a couple hours steam out up on Pigeon Hill, and basically, very close to that time, I started getting the mal de mer, and so I went over and I threw up. And I did what they said, go right back to work. And so working for another half hour, and then it came again. And, after a while, there's nothing left to give. That's the dry heave. We all know that one. And so at some point, the fellow on deck says, well, maybe you should go lie down in the pilot house, and maybe you'll come back to yourself. And, of course, that would be a bad thing to do because then you'd literally be laying back. So I go into the pilot house because at this point it's starting to make sense that would be the thing to do. And in the pilot house, there's the muffler comes up through the pilot house, the 671 Detroit diesel that's down there goes through the roof. So you go in there, it's 90 degrees, and it's, diesel. And so I look up to the wheel, and there's Bill. He's smoking a cigar and eating a cheese sandwich. Yeah. So, in any event, I wasn't in there for maybe just a few seconds and went out on deck and continued what I was doing. And basically, I don't know, you know, and that's the only day ever threw up in all the years fishing was that first day. And I don't know if there's a moral to the story, but maybe it is that, you know, sometimes you're better off out on deck throwing up. Thank you.
Yeah, Ken, I do know what you mean, to being out there. Oh, no. We all know it, right? Thank you, Ken. Our next storyteller is a really remarkable guy, incredibly talented, and has brought the first baby to Fish Tales. We've never had a baby here. Our youngest audience member ever, beautiful Galen, is here, and Eileen. And Nathan, please come up and tell a story. It's a pleasure to have you here.
The date was July 3rd, 2006. The phone rang, and I picked it up, and I said hello, and the voice on the other side of the line said, "Hello! My name is Toshi. I come to Boston, Logan Airport, July 4, 10 p.m. Bye-bye!" I had met Hitoshi and his girlfriend Yuki while traveling on a remote island in the Pacific three or four years before that. And we shared a very intense week together, the kind of week that bonds you inextricably in such a way that when somebody calls and says, "Hello, my name is Toshi. I come Boston Logan Airport, July 4, 10 p.m. You are most delighted. And you may notice that he did not name an airline or a terminal. So my father and I drove to the airport around 10 p.m. and we drove the loop until we spotted Hitoshi. Hitoshi and Yuki had been studying English in Vancouver, and Hitoshi had ditched the program early and Yuki was staying on in Vancouver, and Hitoshi decided that the best place for him was in Gloucester, Massachusetts. And he's in the back seat of the car and I said, "Hitoshi, how long are you staying with us?" And he went, "Wow. Maybe a 1 week-er. Or maybe a 2 week-er. Maybe a 3 week-er. I don't know." And that was how one of the most wonderful and exhausting summers of my life began. Hitoshi greeted everybody he met. Every single person he passed in the street, he would turn to and he would say, "Hello, my name is Hitoshi. I love America." Cars would stop in the street and they would roll down their windows and they would lean out, and the entire family, kids and the puppies too in the back, would lean out and go, "Hitoshi, Hitoshi, Hitoshi, how are you?" And Hitoshi would go, "Wow, I love America." And I would turn to Hitoshi and I would say, "How do you know those people?" And he would say, "Wow, I don't know." A point of clarification, his name was not actually Hitoshi. He would say, "Hello, my name's Hitoshi." And I would say, "Hitoshi." And he would go, "No." And I would say, what's your name? And he would say, "Hitoshi." And I would say, "Hitoshi?" And he would say, "No." And I'd say, one more time. And he would say, "Hitoshi." And I'd seen it written, and I would say, "Hitoshi?" And he would go, "Oh, yes, Hitoshi." I had a standing gig with my band, What Time Is It, Mr. Fox, down at the White Rainbow. And he would come with us, and he had such a personality that immediately people in the neighboring bars would know that he was there. And so whenever we showed up, people would come in and say, "Hitoshi, you got to come over to the house of Mitch, man. We're going to play some pool. The ladies are looking fine tonight." And Hitoshi would say, "Wow. Beautiful women. Don't tell Yuki." And so he would go off. There are 1,000 Stoshi stories. The greatest challenge for this was editing to the 7 that gives you the core of his personality. We were swimming at the Annisquam footbridge one day. We went down to swim. We'd swum there before. And this particular day, the tide was out. The tide was way, way out. And there was, you know, a foot of water there. And the last time we'd been down there, it was high tide. So he just leapt off. And this time, I go down. And before I can stop him, he's climbed up onto the railing. And he's hurled himself off. And he's doing the 17 spins with the Hurricane moves. And he's going down on his head. And I'm thinking, this is the end. This is the end of Stoshi. I don't know who to call. And he goes down, he lands on his back, and he comes out. He's in like a foot of water, and he comes out, and he goes, whoa. And then his eyes light up, and he plunges his hands into the mud, and his face is in the water, and his feet are up in the air, and he comes out, and he's holding a moon snail, a big shell, and he goes, whoa, I found a treasure! And the thing about Stoshi was that he approaches the world expecting to find treasure at every corner. And so I started looking at the world like, where is the treasure? And of course, if you look at the world the right way, the treasure is everywhere, right? So as he started gaining his confidence in Gloucester and with America, he started striking out on his own. And at first it made me very nervous. There was a day I woke up and he wasn't in the house, and I was concerned. And he didn't come back all day, and I wondered, you know, who do I need to call? And he showed up finally at 11 o'clock at night, and I said, Stoshi, where have you been? And he said, wow, I walk a Gloucester train station. We lived in Annisquam at the time. I didn't know that he knew where the train station was. He said, I go a Boston North Station. I go a Museum of Science. I go a Museum of Fine Arts. I go a Boston North Station. Return to Gloucester, I meet beautiful woman. We have love connection. She come your show tomorrow night. Don't tell Yuki! And so the next night, we go down to the White Rainbow for our gig, and right away, the folks from the House of Mitch come over and say, you know, the ladies are especially hot tonight. You should come over. And he goes, whoa, don't tell Yuki. And off he goes. And about halfway through our set, I realize that there's a woman sitting alone in the restaurant, and she is one of the most beautiful women that I've ever seen. I don't say that lightly. Of course, I make my wife the exception now. But she was a woman who had sort of iridescent, translucent skin. She looked elven. She looked like... she had red hair that if you looked at it from a different angle, she would like change dimensions, and she was wearing a shawl that looked like it had been knitted by fairies at a healing pond in the secret woods. That so I went up to her and I said, are you here to see Stoshi? And she said, yeah. Do you know what? But he didn't show up, and so she stayed another hour. And finally left, and Stoshi came back at about the end of our set, and I, you know, what were you thinking, Stoshi? Like, and his answer was inadequate, and I wondered, was he feeling some sort of guilt? Maybe he was planning on marrying Yuki, and I'd asked him, you know, how do you feel about marrying Yuki? And he'd said, maybe no. And when Yuki finally showed up, I asked her too, are you excited about marrying Stoshi? And she explained to me that Stoshi in America was the perfect person, that he was so completely himself and so full of life and so happy and so Stoshi. But in Japan, in the context of this meticulous culture, there was a lot of dissonance for him, that he had a hard time holding down jobs, and her family didn't really approve. And so I thought maybe, I don't know what I thought, I was superimposing, whatever I was superimposing. The next day was my birthday, and we all went out to dinner. And we were at dinner, and he presented me a gift, which I'm going to throw on real quick. It turns out he'd stood up the girl because he was shopping for me. trying to find the perfect present. And I believe this says, happy birthday, crazy best friend. And then he stayed up all night decorating the shirt for me. Before he went back to Japan, several months had passed, and he had borrowed a friend's car and driven all over the country. And he had borrowed my address book, and he had stayed with everybody that I know, which I forget, and then I'll be telling Stoshi stories at a party in Portland, Oregon, and my friends will say, "You know, we know. We all hosted him." The point of Stoshi for me, I got very excited to tell Stoshi stories because anything goes. This is my choice. They're my favorite stories to tell. And then the more I thought about it, the more I realized that for Stoshi, anything goes. Like, it's perfect for him. And I think he wrote it right here where he said, "Let's freedom." But he's the purest version of himself when he's here, at least. And I wondered for myself and for you guys what that would look like. If you could be the purest version of yourself, untethered from whatever social norms you feel trapped in today, what would that look like? And I don't know that for me exactly. But someday I am going to show up in Japan, and the day before I arrive, I'm going to give him a call, and I'm going to say, "How's it going? My name's Nathan. I come Nagoya Airport, July 4, 10 p.m. Bye-bye."
Thank you, Nathan. I also want to give Nathan's band a plug. What Time Is It, Mr. Fox? Please go and check them out if they're playing around. Great band. Our next storyteller is Liz Tulin. Liz works for the Greater Boston Legal Services, and she is a really remarkable person. If anyone you know is going to benefit from earned time off in Massachusetts, Liz is one of the folks that helped to move that law through. So Liz, come on up and tell a story.
It was the summer of 1963, and my friends and I had just graduated from kindergarten. We were free as birds. Swimming lessons hadn't started. And it was probably dead low tide down at the beach because we were spending the morning after having breakfast just playing in the neighborhood. There was a nice wooded area beside my way back yard, and oftentimes that's where we would meet. And that morning, we started to gather. Almost all of us were there at that point. Ricky, Peter, Melinda, Brookie, Michael. But not Jackie. Jackie hadn't arrived yet. Jackie was an unusual child. She was very different. We didn't know what the story was, but we didn't have the words then to describe it. Her parents were like grandparents instead of like our parents' ages. She was quiet or shy, but she had a joyful quality and a lot of innocence. She had red flowing hair and freckles and blue eyes. And we were just waiting for her to join us. Ricky had an idea. He thought it would be fun if we started a club that summer. But he said, in order to have a club, you've got to have an initiation. And Michael said, "What's initiation?" And I said, "You don't watch The Little Rascals? You don't know what that is? It's a test." And Ricky said what the test would be. That the test is to pull down your pants and sit in a pricker bush. And none of us were going to have anything to do with that. But by the time Jackie showed up, Ricky just launched into it. "Jackie, we started a club. And if you want to join it, you've got to pass the initiation test." And she said, "What's an initiation?" And again, we explained. Ricky did. And he looked at her. And he said, "You're going to have to pull your pants down and sit in the pricker bush." Now, at that moment, I don't know where I went. But I think it was someplace deep inside, running away from absolute shame and terror. this little girl pulled down her pants and she sat in that pricker bush. And when I came back into my body, I looked around, and the only people left were Jackie, dissolved in tears of shame and humiliation and pain, and Peter Steen. And Peter reached his hand down into that pricker bush, and he helped Jackie out. And at the same time, he turned to me and he said, "Liz, Jackie needs first aid, and your house is the closest." Well, that was bad news for me. I was now beyond terrified, because now my mother would find out what a shameful person I was, what a horrible thing I had done to a friend of mine. So we walked out of the woods and through the opening in the hedge. We walked underneath the swing set, and each step getting closer to the back porch. We walked past the sandbox. We walked through the badminton court and then through an opening in the fence, past where my dad would barbecue dinner for us at night, over the patio. And that back door was getting closer. We went over the gravel driveway. And now I was really getting anxious, because what was I going to say? Maybe my mother would be down in the basement doing laundry and she wouldn't hear us. Or maybe she would be deeply engrossed in a book she loved reading. Or maybe, just maybe, out running an errand, leaving one of the older kids in charge. I couldn't even bring myself to open up that kitchen door, and I acted like a stranger in my own home, and I knocked on that door. My mother was in the kitchen, and she came to the door, and she saw us there, and sweet as ever, gently opened up the screen door and just bent down, because that was her way with children. She knew how to speak to children with respect and love. And she looked down at Jackie, and she looked at Peter, and she said, "Well, good morning." And Peter said, "Mrs. Malloy, Jackie needs first aid." And my mother looked at Jackie and she said, "Jackie, what happened?" And Jackie said, "Mrs. Malloy, I had an accident and I fell down in the pricker bush." And that day, I realized Jackie passed her initiation with flying colors, but my friends and I failed miserably.
Thank you, Liz. If I misspoke, I meant earned sick time, right? Our last storyteller tonight is Jimmy Tarantino. And I don't see Jim Dowd in the house, right? Jim Dowd's not here. Is he here? I don't think so. Anyway, we're missing Jim Dowd tonight, and hopefully he will be at Schooner Adventure again on September 12th. But I've got Jimmy Tarantino up. And Jimmy is our new storyteller in residence, and he's a fantastic storyteller, and so glad to have him here as part of our group here at Fish Tales. Please welcome Jimmy Tarantino.
Thank you. So I've been invited several times to Fish Tales, always proud to represent. I appreciate Maureen having me, and I've never ever had a script, but because now the pressure is on, I'm storyteller. How do you follow the wonderful Virginia? Which, one more round of applause. I think it took great, it takes great courage for all these storytellers to get up here. I think storytellers, we're like artists or musicians. I mean, they have their instruments or their brushes, and we have our words, and we hope when we convey to you our experiences and our family and our balls and our puke that you can feel our pain and love and passion. And if we do a good job, that's what we do. So I hope to do that tonight. I want to thank all the storytellers who have the courage to come up here and put their balls on the table. This is not an easy thing, so, and thank you all. It took great courage for Maureen to offer me. I'm sure there was conversations of whether I should be fishtail in residence. I am rough around the edges. I am usually politically incorrect. I am opinionated and sometimes rude. But what I love is I think she recognized, and I hope you will recognize tonight, that I am always genuine, I'm always honest, and I'm always Gloucester. So... without further ado, I thought I'd try my hand at poetry. And in the last couple of years, I've tried to put down in words, express things that I am passionate about. These, my friends, my family, my experiences, this is my brush, and I hope you enjoy it and you can feel what I feel, the great passion when I do these things. Starting with, yeah, I am going to need the glasses. A great joy for me this time of year is I spend probably 4 or 5 nights a week on Gloucester Harbor. The dory seems to nod with glee as I stride down the dock with my oars. She, like me, knows she'll soon will be free of the lines that bind to the shores. Captain Gus shouts a sharp morning greeting from the Captain Dominic's deck. In the cool green shade under Fisherman's Wharf, a snow egret cranes its neck. My awareness expands with every stroke of the oar. Out of Harbor Cove I row. To be at sea, free of troubles ashore, is a joy only mariners know. The feel, taste, and smell of the crisp salt air, the wind has the ocean seething. Me and the boat and the sea all share. The waves rise and fall, nature's breathing. The whole harbor now has come alive, a breathtaking unscripted show. Chortling eiders gather close. The cormorants dive, chasing minnows and mackerel below. Peter's sons by the thousands, the finest kind, have called this harbor port home, all possessing the genuine character you'll find in a Homer painting or an Olsen poem. Set my course for the shore, another day ends. In my wake, sunsets catch it in foam. Though I'm blessed on land with fine family and friends, my heart knows this harbor is my home. Thank you. So, you know, I really, obviously I'm passionate about being on the waterfront and being in the dory as I often am. I've had the privilege and honor to get to know the people of Nova Scotia very well. Many families, they've invited me into their homes. I've traveled from Lunenburg down to the Hawk and Clark's Harbor, been in their family and homes in small communities, welcomed there. And I think there's a strong bond between people along the New England coast. So when they came down to June for the International Dory Race, I wrote a toast to the Northeast Coast. Jones, Atwood, Brackett, and Croft, we've known throughout the years. Spindler, Heisen, Mawinney, and Swim, shared laughter and we've shared tears. Atkinson, Nickerson, Mossman, and George, kindred spirits of sea and tide. Henneberry, Zwicker, Knickel, and Heisler, all share our fisherman's pride. From Sambro down to the Hawk's rugged coast, all along that beautiful shore, we raise our glass with respect, we toast, and welcome our friends once more. And that's all. It was just a quick, brief toast. We have a reception for the Canadians every time they come. So, obviously, I hope you get, you know, what I feel both true and passionate about, that strength and the, I see Gloucester going through a lot of changes, and it seems like there's the great value is waterfront property, and the ocean has a whole new value now. There's a more profitable harvest from the sea. But to me, the real value here in this community is the wealth of a Gloucesterman soul. You haven't heard it yet. I'm trying to keep up with the guy with the balls in the pew. Sorry. The wealth of a Gloucesterman soul. From the maritime provinces down to Cape May and every port in between, his eyes have been blessed and he's grateful today for all the great wonders he's seen. But it's the experience he's lived again and again, ingrained in him year after year. The fish, the boats, the places, the men, are the moment his memory holds dear. He's seen sunrise and sunsets with no land in sight, dolphins by the thousands at first morning's light, blue sharks feeding frenzy, humpback whales as they breach, graceful gannets deep diving, harbor seals on the beach. The delight at first sight of old Thatcher's light, the crew are beginning to pace. That sight means they're sleeping home tonight in their woman's instead of winter's embrace. The deckhand sings, the cook blows his nose, the bell buoy rings, the foghorn blows, the cry of a black-backed gull. These nautical sounds every Gloucesterman knows, from the bunk, storm waves pounding the hull. The growl of the winch, the squeal of the block, the splash of the waterfall under the dock as the wash hold melts fish ice above. Knee-deep haddock on deck, a fat shack money check, special moments the fishermen love. The loud, constant rattle of jitterbug forks bouncing over a broken, wet floor. The yells from the hold to the hatch to the wharf keep the fish flowing quickly ashore. Muscles hardened by pulling 1,000 times each. The oars of a dory up on the beach. Stern line aft, spring line forward, bow line taut, stern in, shoreward. Penboards up, a boom hick down. Fighting sleep, he's pulled the night watch from midnight till dawn. Storms got bad, he's pulled into town. A wire basket of whiting, the guts out of cod. To spread wire on the reel, a heavy steel rod. A net full of fish up and over the rail. A rough wooden box of large dabs off the scale. A pallet off the stack, a good captain's leg. The rum jug off a bar in the tap of a keg. They've pulled them all. Good men gather together whenever there's weather. Northeast gales keeps boat. Keep boats tied to the pier. Fried gray sole down Mitch's, cold beer by the pitches, good friends, laughter, and music and cheer. Our waterfront abounds with these smells, sights, and sounds, rich memories more precious than gold, building great strength of character which can only be found in the wealth of a Gloucesterman soul. Thank you. So this last brief piece, and I thank you very much, is just, it's not at all, some people misconceive this, it's not at all about me, it's about my cousin, my friend, and my fisherman friends, and all the community of Gloucester, I believe, which is so precious to me and all of us. I believe if the community could talk, I would hope this is what it would say. I am Gloucester. I am granite enduring. The North Atlantic is in my blood. I am true. My wealth is my culture and heritage. I would rather lose with dignity than win without integrity. My work is not done until the deck is clear. I am proud. I am Gloucester. Thank you. Thank you.